Hello, welcome to Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas. I'm Adam Bolton. It's now been a year since Russia invaded Ukraine, and still there's no clear sense of how and when that war might end. What happens when the fighting stops? In this episode of Worldview, we'll examine the prospects and ask what lessons from history should get the attention of today's diplomats. In the past 250 years, two sets of negotiations carved out versions of world order, in the process creating blueprints for subsequent peace talks. The Congress of Vienna in 1815 ended the Napoleonic Wars. The Treaty of Versailles in 1919 ended the First World War and aimed for a rebalancing of European and world powers to create a lasting peace. I'll be talking to the eminent historians Margaret Macmillan and Andrew Earhart to consider how the legacies of Vienna and Versailles live on today. I'll also speak to Frank Gavin, who'll give us his perspective on peace talks and arms control since the Second World War. And we'll hear from Baroness Ashton, the former European Commission High Representative and Vice President, whose new book, And Then What?, recounts her experience of negotiating settlements. First, a look at the past. Andrew, what did the Congress of Vienna achieve?
I think the first thing is just stepping back and looking at the Congress of Vienna itself and why it even took place. The goal there and the key takeaway was to establish and reestablish a political order on the European continent. And this was after over two decades of periodic wars throughout Europe, at a great loss of life and huge losses of territory and independence at the hands of Napoleon's French armies. So by 1814, there is a great desire for stability on the European continent. So the Congress of Vienna opens in September 1814, then runs for several months to June 1815. And what we have there, when it's all said and done, is a new political order for Europe. So several outstanding issues are settled, from Poland to Saxony to the German Confederation, independence of Switzerland, a unified Netherlands, and what many have called a restoration or a new balance of power for Europe, which then, and this is to your question, why we even study this, is that the Congress of Vienna and the agreements even that came after it helped to establish an order on the European continent that many look at the Congress as establishing an order that lasted up until the First World War in 1914.
The context in which these talks were taking place was that one powerful would-be imperial power had been defeated.
Yes, indeed. And so that's what brings really the four great powers together. So Russia, Austria, Prussia, and Great Britain. I mean, this really gives them kind of a unifying cause. Now, they disagree on many different things, and they have many different visions for what a post-war European order would look like. But there is a unifying principle, which is that France, and Napoleon in particular, cannot be allowed to ravage the continent as they had done for over two decades.
And just the practicalities, how was it conducted? I mean, at what level? Who was there taking the decisions?
Right. So when the Congress opens in September 1814, there's actually a mix of leading statesmen and then their advisors, as well as loads and loads of dignitaries. And it's somewhat notorious and kind of legendary for its great parties and balls. And Beethoven performed several times, for instance. And so while you don't have any formal meetings of all the delegations there, you do have discussions, backroom discussions, but also bilateral and multilateral meetings between the principal powers. And then you also have, and this is largely due to the French diplomat Maurice de Talleyrand, you also have France entering the fray again and beginning to play a role within European diplomacy. But in terms of the actual individuals who were there, Tsar Alexander of Russia is the one kind of heading up the Russian delegation. Within Great Britain, you have Lord Castlereagh, celebrated by many for helping reach consensus and a lasting peace at Vienna. In Austria, you have Prince Metternich, who's an incredibly talented statesman. And then in Prussia, you have King Frederick William III, as well as advisors such as Hardenberg. And they played an important role, but certainly not as important as people like Tsar Alexander, Lord Castlereagh, and Metternich.
And at the end, there was a treaty, was there?
And at the end, there was a treaty. So in June 1815, the final act of the Congress of Vienna is signed, and it's over 121 articles. It's also laying out what many have called a legal framework for the future of European diplomacy. You have two, or really three, agreements after the Congress of Vienna is signed: the Holy Alliance, and this was an idea by Tsar Alexander I to bring the powers of Europe into some sort of understanding and unity going forward, but especially under Christian principles, which then goes on to exercise a great ideological influence within Europe in the years ahead. Now, the second, and this is probably even more important, is you have in November 1815 two agreements. The first is the Second Treaty of Paris, which ends the Napoleonic Wars. But more important, I think, for our discussion is the signing of the Quadruple Alliance, as it came to be known. So again, Russia, Prussia, Austria, Great Britain, pledging an alliance to defeat future aggression from France. Crucially, though, Article 6 of that Quadruple Alliance, and this is written by Lord Castlereagh and really is something that he should be remembered for, speaks of the great powers agreeing to consult, negotiate, meet with one another, as opposed to waging wars of aggression. And so this idea, Article 6, really gives rise to what becomes known as the Concert of Europe in the 19th century. The idea that these great powers agree to meet before declaring war, agree to somewhat limit their aims in order to preserve some sort of regional order.
And if we go forward 100 years, of course, those great powers did find themselves on opposite sides in the Great War of 1914-1918. Margaret Millen, was there any sense in which the Congress of Vienna was a model for the peace talks at the end of that war?
Initially, the powers thought that it would be, but in fact, it turned out to be impossible to replicate the Congress of Vienna because it was a very different time. First of all, there were far more countries involved. This was not just four great powers, although there were four great powers at the heart of the conference: Great Britain and its empire, the United States, France and Italy, which was there more by courtesy, I think, not really a great power as the other three were. Japan was there as an ally in the First World War. China was there. A number of smaller powers were there, of course, Belgium, Greece, powers from Latin America. So it was a much more global conference. And I think the crucial factor that was different was that public opinion mattered much more. And the First World War was fought in a very different sort of world than the world of the Napoleonic Wars, where people had much more say in what their governments did and could throw them out of office. I mean, those leaders of the powers in Paris in 1919, Woodrow Wilson from the United States, Lloyd George from Great Britain, and Clemenceau from France, and Orlando from Italy, were all very conscious that they had to win elections. And so the pressure on them was, in a way, much more than the sort of pressure that the peacemakers had felt at the Congress of Vienna. And there were a great many correspondents there. The conference in Paris was covered by the world's press. I think there was something like 700 news correspondents in Paris. And so the circumstances in which they were making peace was different. And Europe itself and the world were very different, not just because of the spread of democracy and constitutional government and because of the importance of public opinion, but also because the turmoil which had been set in motion by the First World War hadn't ended. In fact, if anything, it was increasing. Russia had had a revolution, two revolutions in 1917, I think partly caused by the pressures put on the Russian regime by the First World War. And what you also had was continuing conflict. I mean, the Napoleonic Wars had ended finally with the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. And I think the revolutionary fires set off by the French Revolution of 1789 had pretty much burnt themselves out. Europe was ready for peace. Europe in 1919, or large parts of Europe in 1919, were not ready for peace. And there were going to be a whole series of small wars and insurrections lasting really until the mid-1920s. So a very different world, very different challenges than 100 years previously.
And also, what about the aim of the peace talks? Was that very different in the sense that, as Andrew's just explained, at the Congress of Vienna, there was the idea of establishing a concert of Europe, of active collaboration between the great powers. What would one describe as the primary aim of the people meeting in Paris?
Well, I think they had several aims. That was part of the problem. I mean, each national leader had aims for his own country, and they were all men in those days. But you also had a general desire, certainly being pushed and pressured, coming from a lot of the publics, for some way of preventing a war like the First World War, the Great War, as it was called then, from ever happening again. And so there was a tremendous hope and anticipation that a new world order was going to be born. And the Congress of Vienna, and I think Andrew explained it very well, was much more conservative. I mean, it was to put an end to a revolutionary period, a period of upheaval, and to reestablish order and stability. And that wasn't the aim of a lot of people who were meeting in Paris. And certainly public opinion, as it watched the Paris Peace Conference, watched it hoping that a very new way of dealing with international affairs would come about. And so that is where you got the impetus behind the League of Nations, which was meant to be an organization which would provide collective security for its members and outlaw war. In a funny way, I don't think the aims of the Congress of Vienna were nearly as grand and as sweeping as some of the aims that came out of the Paris Peace Conference.
Was there a difference in the sense that there was a desire to punish the loser, to punish Germany?
Yes, there was also that. I mean, there's always a desire to punish the loser. And of course, as Andrew again pointed out, what was significant about the Congress of Vienna is that France was represented. And I think that made a great difference because the defeated power that had caused so much havoc was now buying into the new system. And what you had at the Paris Peace Conference was, yes, a real desire for revenge. And so making peace, I think, was a lot more difficult in 1919 than it was in 1814, 1815.
Andrew, just had differences there pointed out between the two peace negotiations, Vienna and then Paris. Would you agree on those?
I think broadly speaking, yes. Vienna occurred after really great revolutionary upheaval. So something that wasn't mentioned, but I know Margaret's done amazing work on this, is the role of even nationalism and what that meant and the idea of self-determination, of national identity, and what that meant for the Paris Peace Conference. I mean, these are huge, huge societal forces that really were not as present in a big way in Vienna.
Who was represented, Margaret, in Paris? Was there a German representation?
Those who were represented in Paris were the winning side, minus, of course, Russia, because it had dropped out of the war early in 1918. The Germans were summoned and told, basically, here are the terms. You have 2 weeks to comment on them in writing. There will be no negotiations, which is something the Germans resented bitterly. But from the Allied point of view, they could not afford to prolong the peace conference unnecessarily, and they couldn't afford to try and push through a set of demands which they'd only agreed on with great difficulty.
Was that the big mistake? I mean, one would say that Vienna was, in its aftermath, more enduring, wouldn't one, than Paris?
I don't think what actually happened in the negotiations made all the difference. I think what mattered is the ending of the war and the refusal of Germany or certain key factors in German society, including the military and the general staff, to accept the fact that Germany had been defeated. And the problem also was that the Allied powers didn't have the will or the capacity to actually enforce the peace terms that they had imposed on Germany. They got Germany to sign the Treaty of Versailles, but they didn't actually have either the will or the enforcement mechanisms to actually make it stick. But I think the real problem was what happened during and after the peace conference and the inability of the Allies and Germany to come together. There were brief moments of hope in the 1920s when it looked like things were getting better and Germany joined the League of Nations. But the real problem was unresolved issues left over from the First World War.
And Andrew, I suppose another big difference was that was the United States remotely relevant in Vienna?
The U.S. comes in just, at least in terms of relevancy, very slightly, and that is Lord Castlereagh comes to Vienna with certain non-negotiables. One is that Britain will retain its maritime rights, and second, that no other powers on the European continent are going to interfere with Britain's war with the United States. But even before Vienna, Castlereagh is going to his allies in the coalition saying, these are non-negotiables.
And Margaret, by the time Paris was taking place, was the United States already the big dog in the room?
Not as much, I think, as people have thought since. The United States became a global power, a leading world power, as a result of the Second World War. But although it was powerful at the end of the First World War, powerful economically, it had not yet, I think, translated that great economic and demographic and other sorts of power into military power. So the United States, yes, was powerful, but Britain with its empire remained very powerful indeed. And for many people at the time, Britain was much the greater world power. But I think from the point of view of the Americans, they were more considerable power. They had advanced economically. They had built more of an armed forces. They were beginning to challenge and in some cases take over from Britain in various parts of the world in things such as trade. But I don't think the United States saw itself as trying to supplant Britain at that point. It simply saw Britain as a power that had to be dealt with.
The historians Margaret Macmillan and Andrew Earhart there. With the creation of the League of Nations in 1920s, a new age of diplomacy began, one dominated by the American worldview. Joining me to discuss American power and the post-war period is Frank Gavin. He's from the Kissinger Center at the School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins University. After the Second World War, did the parties follow the pattern of negotiated treaties on the model of Vienna and Versailles?
I'll give you, to my mind, one of the most interesting examples. The height of the Cold War conflict really was between 1958 and 1962, the crises over Berlin, which ultimately culminated in the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the aftermath of that, both the Soviets and the Americans realized they'd come close to the precipice, and there was a discussion about how do we remove the underlying tensions that generated the crisis in the first place. And there were a lot of uncomfortable issues surrounding political and military status, particularly because of the experience of the interwar period. The British and the Americans didn't want to explicitly put certain parts of this agreement in the public record. So what you had in the spring and summer of 1963, the negotiations of the Partial Test Ban Treaty. When you look at both the Partial Test Ban Treaty and the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, these were international accords, created their own sort of mechanisms, and they were global in nature. But the actual important parts of the deal were negotiated between the Soviets and the Americans with the help of the British. The theory being that if you went to the West Germans and said you couldn't have nuclear weapons, that would be humiliating. But that if you had an international treaty and asked everyone in the world to sign it, that Senegal signs a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, it's a little less embarrassing if West Germany has signed it as well.
And what about understandings that were reached about places like India and in Africa, the so-called non-aligned nations, where clearly there was a kind of Cold War competition?
You know, on those, I think what ends up happening, what's really interesting after this kind of post-63 arrangement where the Cold War competition moves to other parts of the world, and there is this competition, as you allude to, with non-aligned states. The rules of the road there were far less clear. And, you know, to give another example, you know, at the same time that you are settling the sort of outstanding European security issues through the Helsinki Agreement in a very formal, official sort of way, the Soviets and the United States are competing fiercely in places like Angola, South and Latin America, over influence. So I think in that part of the competition, you never really had any of the sort of formal or informal arrangements that did mark the really important issues of stabilizing the competition in Europe.
But a sort of understanding that you couldn't go too far, that Russia couldn't go too far.
Yeah, no. And it is really interesting. And it's a contrast to the current competition between the United States and China today, where there seems to be less ability to figure out what these implied understandings are and what are the lines you can't cross. The Soviets and the Americans, after 15, 17 years, by the early and mid 60s, had sort of gotten a much clearer sense of where you could go and where you could not go and where you compete and where you could not compete.
And what about Indochina, in particular, the talks in which Henry Kissinger was so involved to bring a peace to Vietnam?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because one of the great ironies, as you know, is that we now know that the United States, as they escalated further in 64 and 65, weren't overly confident, as we once assumed. And as they started seeing things were getting worse in 66 and 67 and 68, tried to find a way out. And in fact, Dr. Kissinger was involved in some very interesting informal conversations. But one of the ironies here was that the United States, both Johnson and Nixon, were hopeful that the Soviet Union would help bring about such talks or such a settlement. And the Soviet Union was in the ironic position in that it wasn't thrilled that the United States was involved in this conflict. There was a certain amount of schadenfreude, of course. But just as the U.S. and the Soviets were starting to stabilize their relationship through these implicit agreements, the United States was threatening to undermine it. And of course, this was at a time where the Sino-Soviet rivalry was emerging more, and the Soviets were somewhat limited in what they can do. And Nixon and Kissinger explicitly tried to connect various agreements with the Soviets, particularly arms control settlement that would allow the United States to leave the war in Southeast Asia with some sort of honor. And the Soviets both had some hesitation to do that and also were limited in their ability to kind of bring something like that about.
And at that stage, was it really the Soviet Union that was more important than China, which of course geographically more directly involved?
You're absolutely right about this. One of the great ironies, of course, is that there had been this long simmering distrust between all the players. And the one thing that was keeping them all together was the United States being there. Once the United States figured out a way to extricate itself, it exposed all of those fissures, primarily between the Soviets and the Chinese, but also between Vietnam and China, and also even between the North Vietnamese and the NLF.
And what do you think the international parties concluded? Did they draw any lessons from the way that Vietnam and of course, fighting in Cambodia as well was eventually concluded?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because I think it's one of these things that you look back in retrospect and things turned out so much differently. You had a situation where the United States seemed severely, if not gravely, wounded in many ways, and the Soviet Union appeared to be on the ascendant. But of course, we now know that what was going to happen over the next 10 or 15 years was actually to reverse that again, and that the United States was not as wounded as it appeared. And the Soviet Union was perhaps overly burdened and had the seeds of its own destruction within it in ways that people didn't recognize. And of course, that's all reversed by the end of the decade, when the end of the Carter administration, and particularly with the Reagan reversal, you have a renewal of that competition in a way that exposes a lot of Soviet weaknesses and a lot of Western strengths.
To what extent do you feel that those arms control issues contributed to the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989?
So arms control is a really fascinating subject in that we don't have a tendency to realize that it's a rather modern development. There have been peace treaties and treaties to end wars and treaties to regulate relations between states, but the idea that you would focus on a particular class of weaponry or armament as the source of underlying tension and either seek to limit its increase or eliminate it is a rather modern, novel feature. But one of the things I think that a lot of people in the arms control community don't often recognize is that these treaties, like the aforementioned Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Partial Test Ban Treaties, were actually convenient instruments for states to talk about great power politics, whether it was SALT, whether it was INF, that in a lot of ways, you look through the details and you see Kissinger and Nixon not really caring a whole lot about the particular technical details, but recognizing the overarching geopolitical import. I think the same is true when you look at the intermediate range ballistic missile treaties. The idea was that not only do you eliminate a whole class of weapons, but you're highlighting the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union are going to come to an accord over how Europe is going to be regulated. So I think, to your question, the fact that the Soviets and Gorbachev were willing to pursue the elimination of these weapons was a pretty strong indication that they had an interest in stabilizing the situation, perhaps because they were starting to perceive their own weakness in the competition. And of course, while it's heralded as this great move towards peace, which it was also an indicator that perhaps the Soviet Union was in a bit more trouble than people recognized.
Which brings us right up to date, really. How do you see a process of negotiations or talks possibly bringing an end to the conflict in Europe, the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
One of the ironies of living in a world with democracy and public opinion is that the kind of treaties that European dynasties could sign, where you carved up territory after Westphalia, after Utrecht, even after Vienna, which could generate stability, are no longer really politically possible. When you think about the wars that we've had since World War II, they've either ended in total victory, where one side can more or less impose a peace, or they've more or less kind of come up with just implied arrangements or frozen conflicts. And I think the model that, you know, my colleague Sergei Rodchenko talked about in the New York Times piece a couple of weeks ago was the idea that maybe the best we can hope for is something similar to the armistice in 1953 that ended the fighting on the Korean Peninsula. There was no peace treaty, there was no resolution of the underlying issues, but there was a decision to stop fighting.
Baroness Ashton was the European Union's High Representative and Vice President. She won praise for her work as a negotiator in difficult international situations, in particular, the Serbia-Kosovo agreement and the interim agreement on the Iran nuclear program. What's it like to be in the room? And for the Iran deal, what was it like in particular?
First of all, the Iran P5 plus one, EU 3 plus 3, the six countries working to try and reach an agreement with Iran to be certain they were not building a nuclear weapon. And those were talks that I chaired and led for over 4 years. The Serbia-Kosovo Brussels agreement, where my role was much more to mediate between the two prime ministers to get them to think about how to make life better for the population, particularly living in the north of Kosovo. Each was very different in terms of what we were trying to do, who we were talking to, and in a sense, what we were able to achieve.
And only in some of them, as it were you bringing two lots of belligerents together. In the case of Iran, that was world opinion or Western opinion versus Iranian opinion.
Very much so. And of course, it was a very technical discussion all the way through, that the negotiations had at their heart a technical debate about whether a program that was meant to be purely for civil use could be so engineered and so watched over that we could be confident in what it was trying to do and be confident that we would know if Iran was making a different decision. So some negotiations have huge technical issues at their heart, and those are things you have to get to grips with. Whereas others, you're really dealing with political questions.
And of course, Donald Trump, President Trump, withdrew from the agreement. So with hindsight, what do you think you actually managed to achieve?
It's very difficult to look back without a great deal of sorrow and irritation, to put it mildly, that all of the work that was done to get us to an agreement where people could have confidence in a purely peaceful nature of Iran's program was simply thrown away. And it had an additional damaging effect, which was that the P5 plus one negotiations were the only time that the permanent members of the Security Council worked together on an issue and stuck together on that same issue. And we were the ones, in a way, who threw it away. And that meant we went back to square one. Iran is now moving closer to a nuclear weapon, and the capacity of the P5 to work together on any issue has been, of course, dramatically reduced.
Jonathan Powell, a former chief of staff for Prime Minister Tony Blair, he has said that the necessary ingredient for peace talks is effectively that both sides are hurting. Would you agree?
That's an interesting thought. I think I would say the ingredient is much more about both sides seeing that there's a reason to move forward. And if you take Serbia and Kosovo, who, when I brought the two prime ministers together, they had never met. It was in circumstances where politically and economically they couldn't get anywhere unless they could get closer to Europe. Europe was a huge pull. The European Union's capacity to support their economy and help them with peace and security was enormously valuable as a prize. And the only way to do that was to resolve the differences between them. So it gave them the incentive, but also gave them something they could sell back home when they were making difficult decisions. Look, you know, they could say, look, we're doing this in order that we can get closer to the European Union. And that was really helpful.
And what was the experience like for you? Because here you are dealing with elected heads of government and presidents and people. You are coming in as a diplomat and actually, at the beginning, not someone who was that well known.
You're putting it kindly, I think, Adam. Not well known, not regarded as the person who probably should have been doing the job by quite a lot of people, either because they thought they should be or because they thought somebody with greater experience in more traditional foreign affairs would be more appropriate. So for me, it was very much about trying to put my head down and get things done, because the only way I could prove that I could do it or discover I couldn't was to really try. By the time I was doing most of these negotiations, I'd built the Foreign Service and I was more used to the ways of working when you're bringing together 28 countries in support of what you're doing. And that was incredibly important in all of these negotiations. I didn't stand alone. I stood representing the whole of the European Union. But it was tough. It was hard work. And it was really, in all these cases, about trying to find the key that would turn in many different aspects of the agreements we're trying to reach, that would turn the lock that would lead us into the possibility of an agreement. I described it like a jigsaw puzzle. When the puzzle is made and you look at it, it doesn't matter what shape and size the pieces are, as long as they fit together.
Baroness Ashton there, the only woman ever to be the European Union's High Representative. Well, today the big question is how the Ukrainian conflict is going to end. What needs to be done to get Ukraine into the best possible position for talks to take place? To conclude this episode of Worldview, I asked our contributors, Margaret McMillan, Andrew Earhart, Frank Gavin and Baroness Ashton, for their thoughts.
There are a number of factors at play, as there were in Vienna and as there were in the ending of the First World War, and that is the role of the great powers, the people with some influence and some authority. And one hope for bringing about an ending of the war in Ukraine is to get some form of cooperation between at least China and the United States. Well, EU, I think, is very important here as well. And if those three can come together and begin to push the sides to talk, then that may bring about peace or at least a ceasefire. But it's very, very difficult, I think, to see at the moment. I think neither the Russian side nor the Ukrainian side want to make peace, and you can understand why they don't. But very dangerous at the moment, I think, to make any predictions. There are too many moving parts.
Something that is present in 1815, really 1814 and 1815, and then 1919, as well as 1945 in the settlement that concluded the Second World War. And that is the position and the capability of military forces when an armistice is signed, if an armistice is signed, but especially when powers begin meeting to negotiate.
I am not optimistic that you could have a Versailles-like conference where you would settle these issues. You're not going to get a sort of a Dayton Accords type of thing either. Absent an external third party like the United States forcing one or the other two sides to sit down, which the United States is not going to be interested in doing, it's hard to see the two sides coming to any kind of permanent arrangement that's mutually satisfactory.
Well, what I believe even now that we should start thinking about is a process of negotiation. Who's going to be around the table and where is it going to take place? I joke about the fact you can spend an awful long time arguing about the venue or the table, but I've been in circumstances where we've done that, and it just wastes political time and energy. I think for Ukraine, they should be thinking, if we ever get to that point, where do we want to meet? Who do we want to host? Who do we want to have around the table? And that will be determined by what issues they think are most significant to discuss and by what their allies are talking to them about. And that really matters, because when things change, they can change quite dramatically. And one of the things you need to be ready with is the process. And the sooner we're thinking about what that might look like, even if it's not for years to come, I think the better we serve Ukraine.
Let's hope there's peace in Ukraine soon. But where does war end and peace begin? And what role does diplomacy play in that transition? As war continues, so does the search for peace. It can seem a distant prospect in the midst of brutal conflict. But peace talks of the past demonstrate that the impossible can be achieved. Worldview is produced for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The Worldview series editor is Murray Jessel. Our producer is Eve Webster, and the sound engineer, Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.